I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. As a sort of state of the industry report, Alan Haig Brown looks at the West Coast's once prominent commercial fishing industry in a new book, Still Fishing, the BC Fishing Industry Revisited. It's a timely book looking at how this industry is faring in these less than stable economic waters and other exigencies such as corporate consolidation, closing processing plants, and the downsizing of fleets. The book from Harbor Publishing also looks to the future with profiles of unique people who continue to fish commercially, hopefully preserving an industry that's been so much a part of British Columbia. Alan Haig Brown joins me now. He is a longtime journalist and writer. He seined salmon and herring through the 1960s and 70s and founded the West Coast Mariner and West Coast Logger. His previous books include Fishing for a Living and the Fraser River. His website is at haigbrown.com. That's haig-brown.com. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Alan Haig Brown. Good morning, Mr. Haig Brown.
Good morning, Mr. Planta.
Thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here.
You wrote a book in 1993. I haven't seen the book.
It's out of print.
Yeah, Fishing for a Living, right?
Yes.
And is this a sequel to that?
Interestingly, it is and it isn't. I had talked to Howie White at Harbor Publishing about reissuing that because it did sell quite well, and I do get people asking for it. However, he pointed out that since that was done on film and we've changed to digital, in the meantime, the cost and complexities of republishing are unreasonable. I had thought if we republished it, I'd like to follow up on some of the people in boats. So when I looked at it, I thought, well, let's just do a new book, following up on some of the people in boats, which is what Still Fishing is. So in that sense, it is a sequel. And as much as publishing has changed from film to digital in those intervening years from 93, so also has the fishing industry changed beyond recognition.
And so I was going to ask that. So if we picked up that book and this book and compare them, the industry has changed. In terms of size, how has it changed?
Fewer boats. Many of the boats by name would still be there. Mostly the wooden boats have been replaced with aluminum and steel, which certainly was happening in 93 and earlier than that. But now, with the change in licensing, which again was beginning to happen in 93, we've dramatically reduced the size of the fleet through two things, corporate concentration and government buyback. So by taking boats out of the fleet, we satisfied the economists that have a wonderful chant that they take around the world, actually saying, too many boats chasing too few fish. But this is an economic view that looks at return on capital investment without any regard to the human resource that's involved. So we get a guy that told me from a little port way up north how he got 30,000 pounds of halibut quota and was able to sell it for, I think in the days, $20-$25 a pound. He made a lot of money. He made a trip to Seattle, had some Starbucks coffee, and said, my body's made for better fuel than that, and went back to his little neighborhood. Well, now, to provide work for that guy, we have to have government make work programs, or he has to move to the city. The very job that sustained him and his parents for years in the rural community of fishing halibut no longer exists. It will be that halibut quota, likely today, would be owned by a corporation in Vancouver who leases it out at perhaps $3.50 a pound to a halibut fisherman who goes out and delivers his fish back to this guy for $5 a pound. So now we have halibut fishermen fishing for less money, less well able to maintain their boats, more worried about meeting their crew shares and costs, and intense capitalization and corporate concentration in the fishery. Nothing that I see as good.
Growing up, I've always heard this idea that there are too few fish. Is that the case, though?
In some cases, there are too few fish. In other cases, that it's not. The sardines have come back dramatically, and we have a chapter on John Lennick and other people who are fishing that very well. Since I wrote this book, my former brother-in-law, Daryl Asu, has begun fishing sardines. So the sardine fishery is doing very well. The fishery that's best known to British Columbians, and rightly so, is the salmon fishery. And the salmon fishery is the spiritual core of, of this province has been since time immemorial. It's what created, you know, the beautiful works that sustain the Anthropology Museum at UBC that we take our visitors to see. That comes from the amazing cycle of the salmon, which we all know, they swim up the rivers, but their swimming up the rivers makes them particularly vulnerable to the sort of population growth and habitat depredation that we know. We've done away with probably 80% of our habitat in the Fraser River. I spoke just last night with Gus Jacobson, who's got a chapter here on his little boat and fin sloop, and he was talking about being down at Steveson and seeing the little pink and chum salmon fry swimming in and around the boats there. Those little fish need marshland transition. At the same time, there's an application, I believe, from Fraser Wharves in Richmond to take away a little more habitat. And, oh, they'll do a no-net loss, something else. But not good enough.
Yeah. When you worked in the industry, this was in the 60s and 70s, right?
Yes.
What did you do?
Yes, it was.
What did you do at the time?
I was just a deckhand on my then father-in-law's same boat. I have a chapter in here on the Asu family, and that is the same family that I fished with years ago, and I've gone back with them on their boats today and fished the same tides in the same places as a writer, photographer. And so the deckhand on a purse seiner worked for a share, roughly 10% of the total catch, and so it was a common joint venture sort of thing. It was a beautiful thing. And at 18, when I first went on the boat, it was a wonderful growing and learning experience for me. It also took me up into all of the inlets and taught me the coast and taught me BC. And incidentally, of course, I was with First Nations people, so I was learning a particular perspective and respect for the waters and the lands that we were seeing.
Did you go into this line of work because you wanted to go into the fishing industry? I would think with your father and grandfather that you were going to be a writer.
Well, of course, one never wants to be what their father and grandfather are.
Yeah.
That's why my father left England at 18 and came to North America, although he did intend to be a writer. I married the skipper's daughter and left high school. It was 1960, but it was very much the 50s era. I fished for a time, and then I went back to school and became a school teacher and worked in education for 20 years. But in the 80s, I would come to the coast and I would see the decline in the boats. I was also working a lot with First Nations people on recording their oral histories. And while it wasn't appropriate for me to go and do First Nations stuff, it made me think more of it. So I took a tape recorder and I went to see high, well-known captains like Charlie Clark and people like that I wouldn't have talked to when I was a lowly deckhand. But as you know, with a tape recorder and a notebook in hand, we're given special powers in this culture.
Yeah.
to go and interview people, and I learned a lot. Those people told me about the beginnings of the commercial fishery, and great quotes from them that are in the earlier book from Louis Persic, a Croatian fisherman, who looked at the fisheries management here and said, you know, in the old country, we never ate our seed potatoes, as a comment on how DFO managed our fishery.
Yeah. Do you find that there are people, young people, who want to go into this industry?
Absolutely. Both who want to and who need to. So I'll look at the two of them. Myself, I wanted to because I was growing up in Campbell River and real men were either loggers or fishermen. So
yeah.
That was a want. But also I needed to. I was immature. I was messing up in high school. I was failing everything. And I needed to go up and have a better student-teacher ratio. On the same boat, I had, on Herring, I had seven older men teaching one kid. So that was a wonderful opportunity for me to learn some responsibility and how to work. But there are also young people, often the children of commercial fishermen, but certainly not necessarily, who would love to get into the fishery. Well, I realized quite quickly that I was not skipper material. This was a great job for me, but I took myself back to school. The other people who may be skipper material look at the situation and they say, well, gosh, maybe if I worked hard, and we've got Russell Sanderson in here, going out on black cod boats, which is a good, strong, healthy fishery and making good money. But he can't look at buying both a boat and quota and to catch salmon. He could maybe afford the $50,000 to $100,000 for the boat, but now you add on to that another $150,000 to $200,000 for quota, which is a totally artificial price that has been created by government limiting the number of boats, and not only limiting the number of boats, allowing this to be used as speculative private property, which was a common property resource. So now, fisherman wants to go out, he has to bid against all sorts of other people who may be corporate people, maybe people who have a vertically integrated company that profit and loss all the way up and down. So it makes it very difficult for a young person to buy into the fishery.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book this colonial approach to managing the industry and the resources therein on the part of the government. You just talked about that. Can we get away from that in any way, shape, or form in the future?
Yes, I think we can. And the model, of course, is to look at Alaska. I don't know if Alaskans would like it, but they were, in effect, a colony of the Southern 48 until they got their independence in the, 60-something.
Yeah.
When they did, they immediately said, the fishery is one of the resources we have. It sustains our coastal communities. It sustains our voters, the legislator said. They actually even took oil money and put it into the fishery. They built the fishery because they wanted to keep people living in their coastal communities and keep those coastal community people voting for them. So what they did was when they brought in a limited entry saying you can't have any more salmon seine boats than you presently have, they also said we're going to license the fisherman. The license is tied to the fisherman. He must be on the boat when the boat is fishing. In Canada, because we come from a monopoly and a colonial history with the Hudson Bay and the railroads and the tree farms, the whole direction of our federal government is to concentrate things so that they don't have to go to embarrassing meetings with public fishermen lecturing them on how to manage the fishery. They can go and meet with a few nice corporate executives and take care of things. So the Alaskan model, I think, is a very important one for us. Southeast Alaska's coastline looks exactly like BC's coastline. I've been up there and fished there also, and it looks like BC.
There's this Cohen Commission of Inquiry into the salmon stocks on the Fraser, the sockeye salmon stocks on the Fraser. Do you think that'll accomplish anything?
I'm a Canadian, so I don't have a lot of faith in commissions, but I'm also a Canadian and eternally optimistic and eternally hopeful, and I guess I would even say I'm my father's son, and all I understood from him was not any rights but responsibilities. And so we have this responsibility to do the best we can to improve that river, to make it sustainable, to get real and stop taking the quick money of real estate developments on the banks of the river, of fish farms, on the courses that the salmon have to swim through. It just is. It's just such a third world mentality that we have here of exploitation, and the opportunity to stand on grandstands with, you know, flying 3-plane load of people in to witness you saying you're going to kill a river as they did last week on the Peace. So the commission, I think, I really hope, I know it will come up with excellent stuff, like amazing people. Including commercial fishermen, will make presentations to it that are wise, that are thoughtful, that are very good, and I'm sure that the commission will write it up very well. It's a question of whether we have the political will to implement these things. Department of Fisheries and Oceans has been filled with wonderful biologists who were very committed to the resource, but when one of them spoke out against the Nechaco diversion that was going to harm the salmon and the water temperatures at Hell's Gate, he was demoted and moved into another position. So the political interference has been really damaging.
In the book, you tell some optimistic stories. The one that I found interesting was Lon Trung.
Yes.
Can you tell us about him?
Lon's a Vietnamese refugee from the 70s and tells his story of going out across the Gulf of Thailand and finding his way up into Thailand, a refugee camp, and eventually to Canada, where think he ended up in Toronto as a welder, but got his way to the BC coast, has a bought a fishing boat, a shrimp fishing boat, which is a lot of other Vietnamese refugee fishermen have taken up, and now works incredibly hard and catches his shrimp. He and his wife and children sell them off the fresh sales dock out in Steveston, which incidentally is a wonderful thing and people should see. And what he's doing is what generations of immigrants have done, early Scottish immigrants, early Norwegian, Yugoslav, Japanese, have come and have worked a really hard generation, putting their kids through school. Some of the kids have gone on to become fishermen. Many have gone on to become doctors and lawyers and such. He is prepared to work that hard for his children and to make this potential life. I actually stopped down to visit him the other day, and he's bought a second boat. It's a small trawler, and he wants to go out and get bottom fish. He'll bring those in. His wife will sell them off the dock while he takes his shrimp boat out and fishes for 3 weeks alone with this heavy gear. And then he'll bring that back in, and they can fill shrimp while he goes out and fishes the trawl for bottom fish, lemon sole, and things like that. So the commitment to work, I had to struggle a bit to get him to sit down and have a cup of tea with me, is huge. And I've spent some time in Vietnam and some of those countries and see how hard people work. So this is a huge resource in terms of giving immigrants that want to work that hard access to a Canadian way of life. Lon also has bought a little farm back in the Mekong Delta and talks about retiring there someday.
It's a hopeful book, isn't it?
I really want it to be a hopeful book. I really want to show that the fishing industry has changed dramatically, but we have a lot of young people. We have wise old people like Hutch Hunt teaching his grandson, Mark Peter, that are looking for little niches, looking for ways to add value. Huge strides have been made in maintaining the quality. When I fished salmon back in the 60s, we used to use a pitchfork. It was a pew, a single fork thing, and we'd throw the fish up with that. Now, when they move the fish, they use it with what they call hand bombing. You pick it up with two hands, one on the head, one on the tail, so that you don't separate the joints. But they also cool them better. Our old wooden boats were not good at keeping them well in the fish hold. Now they've lined and glassed those. They've added refrigeration. Many fishermen are now freezing their own catch on board, particularly those that want to stay independent. They'll freeze it on board and put it in their cold storages out in Cloverdale and then sell it piecemeal over the winter. So you can actually buy good sockeye sushi in Japanese restaurants in Vancouver year-round now, partly because of independent fishermen are keeping that little bit of fish they get and stretching it out and making a proper return on it. So there's some really innovative stuff. Fishing herring for salmon bait would have been considered a bit of a tedious fishery in my day. People wanted to fish lots. Well, now people are prepared to put in that extra labor, do some onboard processing. Again, we could do some regulations about onboard processing to include and encourage independence and stop stuffing salmon into cans. You've eaten sockeye. It's far too good a fish to be just canning it. It deserves some royal treatment.
Yeah. 17 years from now, one would think that you'd write another book. What do you think the industry will look like then?
I hope it will be not much larger than it is in terms of the fishing fleet, but much more diverse in terms of the processing and the handling and the delivery of this beautiful resource that we have to the consumer. Now, that also will depend on British Columbians getting a little more sophisticated. The Asian population increase has helped us a lot in that area. But I did talk to a fisherman in the book who brought his prawns ashore, beautiful. He can sell them at, I think it was $55 per kilogram to Japan, all he can catch. He tried to offer them here in Canada because he felt an obligation to the Canadian consumer, and Canadians don't want to pay $55 a pound for beautiful frozen sea prawns. So hopefully we'll increase in that, and gosh, Vancouver restaurants are doing a great job in that. Most of them now list wild salmon as opposed to farmed salmon. So the consumer in British Columbia is infinitely more sophisticated than I was a kid and came to Vancouver with my father in the 50s, and there was an oyster bar on Granville Street. That was the only place you could buy an oyster on a half shell in this town. So, you know, you can get them all over now. So the 17 years from now, not more boats than now, but more independence, more room to encourage the innovative entrepreneur. There's a fisherman up in Prince Rupert who uses a Portuguese long line, which is a vertical, and he fishes against the bluffs, and he brings in these various fish live in his tanks. The innovation is here. Fishermen who will do that innovation, fishermen who will innovate so that they don't take non-targeted stocks, so they will fish and let the steelhead go by while they take the pink salmon that there are a lot of it, or whatever. All of that innovation can be worked out. They're amazing innovators. When fishermen are owner-operators, they also will police themselves properly. If you simply are an employee of a large corporation, there is not that same motivation. There's not the same vested interest in the coast. Again, my father used to marvel and be happy at sports fishermen on our rivers, even though sometimes they were fishing in the pool he wanted to fish, because he said it's having the public on the rivers and now at sea that keeps the eyes out there, the thinking out there, and questions things. If we didn't have commercial fishermen and others up coast, the salmon farms would be totally free to do whatever they want. Now they are only partly free to do whatever they want. So having entrepreneurs up there, people who are prepared to invest in what it takes to bring a quality fish to shore, I hope that's what we'll see in 17 years, and I hope we'll see respect for our rivers.
Alan, it's been good to talk to you today. Congratulations on this great, necessary book, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much for the interview.
You're very welcome. The website for more is haig-brown.com. The book is called Still Fishing, the BC Fishing Industry Revisited. It's from Harbor Publishing. Do pick it up. It's a great book to read. They're great anecdotes, and it's an important, necessary one, as I said. Its author, Alan Haig-Brown, on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.